Hello, and welcome to New Books in Popular Music, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Matt Smith Larman, and on this episode I'll be talking with Cherie Homer, author of Catch That Rockabilly Fever, Personal Stories of Life on the Road and in the Studio, a 2010 release on McFarland & Company. Rockabilly is a musical genre which began with the advent of rock and roll in the mid-1950s. It's a hard-driving, guitar-centered music with gospel, rhythm and blues, and country roots. Its earliest progenitors include Elvis Presley, Carl Perkins, and Wanda Jackson. And though it has ebbed and flowed in its popularity, it has never gone away. Along the way, it has gained and lost some artistically impressive artists. The Stray Cats, the Cramps, the Paladins, and the Blasters, just to name a few. High Noon, Big Sandy and his Flyright Boys, and Rosie Flores are contemporary artists who carry the rockabilly torch. Not to mention the dozens of rockabilly festivals like Viva Las Vegas, Rockabilly Weekend, and the Rockin' 50s Festival in Green Bay, as well as numerous festivals around the world that feature new as well as original rockabilly artists. Cherie Homer has kept a keen eye on the rockabilly scene her entire life. Her mother introduced her to the music of Elvis Presley at a young age, and, as with so many others, things were never quite the same. For 2 years at the beginning of the century, she published a rockabilly fanzine called Rockabilly Review, and in 2010 published the book that is the subject of this interview. Rockabilly Fever is a compilation of biographical vignettes of 46 movers and shakers in the rockabilly world. There are classic Sun Records rockers like Carl Mann and Ed Bruce, Louisiana hayride artists such as Elvis Presley and Bob Lumen, Arkansas cats like Ronnie Hawkins and Bobby Lee Trammell, Texas rockers like Buddy Holly and the Crickets and Lou Williams, California artists like the Collins Kids and Ricky Nelson, pioneers such as Narvell Feltz and Laura Lee Perkins, revivalists such as Go Cat Go and Tex Rubinowitz, and contemporary rockers such as the Casey Sisters and Sue Moreno. Data for Homer's stories come from a multitude of personal interviews with the artists themselves as well as thorough scouring of the rockabilly literature. Cherie lives in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which is where I reached her for this interview. Well, hello, Cherie, and welcome to New Books in Popular Music.
Hi, Matt. How are you doing today?
I'm well, thank you. So if you could please start off with telling us a little bit about your biography.
Well, I got into music because of my mother. She is quite a bit older than I am. I'm 32, and I hope she doesn't mind me saying this, but she's 72, so she grew up in the 50s, and she loved rock and roll and Elvis Presley and all those kind of people. And when I was growing up, she used to play that kind of music for me all the time. She had a large, and still does, a 45 RPM record collection. So I would hear Fats Domino and Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and Bill Haley and, of course, Elvis, a lot of Elvis and all those kind of people. And so I grew up listening to those guys, and I didn't embrace that in school simply because I was picked on in school, and I didn't want to get picked on any further, so nobody really knew that I liked Elvis until I got older and figured, ah, who cares, you know, they're going to like me regardless. If they do, they do. If they don't, they don't. Well, anyway, so by the time I got to college, you know, everybody knew that I liked Elvis, and if they heard an Elvis song, they'd think of me and whatever. So I started liking all that stuff probably when I was about high school. A junior, I do believe, really getting into it heavily because we had moved to Michigan for a couple of weeks. And then when we came back, I helped reorganize my mom's 45 collection, record collection. And she was going through the songs like stuff by Carl Perkins and Ricky Nelson and Dale Hawkins and Wanda Jackson and people I wasn't really familiar with. And we started listening to that stuff, and I really liked those people. And it just kind of developed. And then in 2002, I had bought a Sun Records compilation, and Sonny Burgess was on there, and Billy Lee Riley, and Ray Smith, and others, but I had basically bought it for the people I was familiar with, like Elvis and Carl Perkins and Jerry Lee Lewis, and I really got into the other people that I didn't know, like Sonny Burgess. When I first heard Redheaded Woman, I was like, wow, where did this come from? I just played it over and over and over again, and so that got me interested in rockabilly. And I started digging deeper, and then we went to the Ponderosa Stomp. When I say we, my mom and I went to the Ponderosa Stomp in New Orleans and saw Dale Hawkins and Joe Clay and Rocky Burnett and Paul Burleson and all these rockabillys, Scotty Moore and DJ Fontana and James Burton, guys that played for Elvis. And then we went to the Green Bay Rockin' 50s Fest, and there were even more rockabillys on that show. And I did interviews there because I had started a rockabilly magazine at that time, or was about ready to start it. And so I did interviews with Buddy Holly's band, the Crickets and the Collins Kids and Billy Lee Riley and all these people. And I ended up putting out my own magazine, Rockabilly Review. And I did that for a couple of years. I had 8 issues with that. And that was really fun and, you know, really cool that those people didn't even know me, but they were willing to give me an interview. The first interview I actually ever did was Dale Hawkins over the phone. And then I did one in person with the Crickets. And I couldn't believe, and my mom couldn't either. She had been listening, you know, as a child, I say a child, a teenager, to Buddy Holly's records. And then to be able to listen or see them in person was really a highlight for her. And of course, I knew who Buddy Holly was. I'm a big fan of his. And to be able to sit and talk to the Crickets and get my questions answered and, you know, really feel like somebody, it was really a cool experience, something I'll never forget. So basically, that's what happened, my transition into rockabilly.
What made you start up the Rockabilly Review, your fanzine?
Just because I had gone down to New Orleans and I saw these people in concert, like Dale Hawkins and Joe Clay and the others that I mentioned, and I thought, how many people know who these guys are? You know, and I knew they were up there in age, and I thought, they need to have their histories preserved. You know, this music is so wonderful, and you know, their history must be really cool because I know that they were from the 50s and I love everything about the 50s. So I just thought that would be a neat thing to do. And I had writing experience because I graduated from the University of Wisconsin Parkside here in Kenosha with a bachelor's degree in English and a concentration in writing. So I had worked for their newspaper, college newspaper, and for their college, I interned, with the college magazine there, and I had taken writing courses and whatnot. So I thought I was, you know, skilled in that area. So I thought, you know, hey, why not, you know, start up a magazine? So that's what I did.
And how did you come to write this book then? What was the impetus for that?
Well, it was my friend Ken Burke who wrote the foreword, really his influence, and my mom and other people. I had been doing all these interviews, you know, for the magazine. I had acquired like probably 100 interviews with different rockabillies. And I had a kind of a backlog because, like I said, the magazine only lasted for 2 years. I couldn't get advertising and it was hard to get people on board to subscribe and whatnot. So that's why I ended up quitting working on it. It was just too expensive. Plus, I had breast cancer in 2004. So all around that same time, I quit it. It was from 2002 to 2004 that I had the magazine. But so I had acquired all these interviews, and everybody was saying, oh, you should write a book, you should write a book. And I thought, oh, I don't know, I've never done anything like that before. But thanks to my friend, he helped me propose a submission letter, you know, and a proposal and an outline and what have you. And I sent that around to like 50 different publishers. And there were a few that were interested, but basically they told me, you know, I don't know what rockabilly is. I don't know how to market it. I don't think it would sell any books, so we're not interested. But then finally, McFarlane came to me actually 3 times, I do believe, and they said, hey, do you still have that book idea? We're interested. So they knew what rockabilly is. My editor's a fan, and they gave me a pretty good deal in regard to, you know, being a writer for the first time. And they were really, really helpful. Anytime I had a question, they'd come back to me right away with an answer, and I was just really pleased. And I'm very pleased with how it turned out, and it's all over in different libraries, Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Dartmouth and overseas, the British Library and the Library of Congress here in Washington, D.C., and of course, a lot of public libraries, L.A. Public Library, and just all over. So it's really cool to think that my book is in that many different places.
Well, that is really cool. Why don't you tell us about the organization of the book? The book is 46, I guess, biographical vignettes, and you've organized it. You have a section on Sun Records. You have some sections on regional rockabillies. How did you decide on the organization of the book?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I just basically... What I tried to do is include as many people that I thought people would be interested in reading about, that they're really, a lot of them aren't, there's not much information out on. And all the people that are in the book are many of my favorites, actually, probably all of them. otherwise I wouldn't have included them. But I just basically thought, okay, well, you know, you got Sonny Burgess and you got Ray Smith. They both recorded for Sun Records. So if somebody recorded for Sun, then basically they'd go in a Sun section. And Elvis wasn't put in the Sun section just because the Sun section was pretty large on its own, and the Louisiana Hayride section really wasn't. And I had so much information on the Hayride because I talked to the engineer, Bob Sullivan, and he gave me a lot of background on how they recorded the show and the setup and the whole deal, and I wanted to put that in there. So I thought, well, I need to have a section on the Louisiana Hayride. So I ended up putting Elvis in that section. And with the Texas Rockabillys, those guys were originally from Texas, like Buddy Holly and Sonny West and Hugh Lindvall. And Rockabilly Revivalists, I think, who's in that section? Marti Brahm, I do believe. She kind of restarted the Rockabilly movement. The Dave and Dee Combo, High Noon, people like that really kind of jump-started the movement here in the States again back in the early 90s. So I thought, hey, that's a good section to put them under. And that's kind of the basic idea. I just, you know, thought of their biographies and where they would most likely be placed.
Right. Now, I hope this isn't a redundant question, but how did you decide which artists to cover? Because obviously there are some very famous people, say Carl Perkins or somebody who you don't put in the book, and some others that most of us have never heard of.
Well, that's the problem in regard to logistics. I mean, there's so many rockabillys. There's thousands and thousands, probably even some that I'm not aware of. So, I mean, my publisher had to put a limit on how many people I was going to include. I mean, you can only have a book so big, you know, and I'm actually going to have a follow-up. I'm working on a Ricky Nelson book right now. I know you're probably going to ask that later, but I'll throw this in now. I'm writing a Ricky Nelson book right now, and as soon as I get finished with that, it's going to be a follow-up to the Rockabilly. To include people that weren't included in the first one, like Dale Hawkins and Carl Perkins and Conway Twitty and, you know, guys like that. So basically what happened was my publisher requires this of everybody that I interview or get a photo from. They want to sign permission slip. Well, some of the people that I interviewed would not sign a permission slip, so therefore they weren't included. For whatever reason, I don't know why they didn't sign a slip, if they didn't get it or they just didn't want to be included or whatever. Or it could be that this happened also, that I didn't have anyone to talk to that would give me any fresh insight. I didn't want to write the same thing over and over again. I know people have given me critique in regard to, oh, well, why did you put Elvis in there? Why did you put Buddy Holly in there? There's so much written about those guys already. And the Elvis section is just kind of there, you know, it's not really saying too much. But I'm very pleased with the way it turned out. I mean, the Elvis section, I thought, you know, because I had interviewed Bob Sullivan and he had never been interviewed before, as far as I know, there was some new things about Elvis that was put in there, you know, that I hadn't seen before. And anyway, you can't have a book on just straight ahead rockabilly. And I'm not trying to downplay rockabilly at all, because I love it. It's the music that's my favorite. But you have to kind of put more mainstream artists in to sell a book. And basically, you know, that's what I do for a living. So I have to sell books. So I put Elvis in there and Ricky Nelson and Buddy Holly and people that would stand out to the regular person, because unfortunately they don't know who the Collins kids are, or Sonny Burgess, or they should, but they don't, you know. And I had to throw in some more popular stars. But that's why Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash and, you know, some of the bigger names aren't in there. Hopefully, you know, like I said, some of those guys will get in the next one.
Right. Here's a more general question then. Is the birth of rock and roll and rockabilly the same thing? And how and when do these genres diverge, or do they diverge?
That's a very good question. It's a thin line between all these genres, between rockabilly, rhythm and blues, rock and roll. You know, they all kind of, what I kind of think of is like the tree of life with branches. like the rock and roll is at the base, and then you have all these branches that are branched off, like you have rhythm and blues, and you have western swing, and you have traditional country, and you have rockabilly, and what have you. You know, all of these different genres are branded together. I don't know how to say it exactly, but, you know, they're combined together to form rock and roll. So rockabilly has elements of rock and roll, but, you know, you can tell a distinct difference. Rock and roll is more polished. It has a more kind of a poppy sound. I'll give you an example. Like, if you listen to Elvis's Sun Records, I hate to keep going back to Elvis because, you know, he's so popular, but it's a good reference. But anyway, Elvis's Sun Records, if you listen to that stuff, it's very raw and primitive and very simplistic in the respect of how much instrumentation there is. I mean, that's basically all there was Elvis on acoustic guitar, Scotty Moore on electric guitar, Bill Black on bass. Sometimes drums, but hardly ever did they have drums on there. So basically that was your lineup. Then he went to RCA. He started in 54 at Sun. By 56, he was at RCA, and he had, a piano, and he had the Jordanaires, and he had, drums with DJ Fontana, and he had, you know, a more, you know, elaborate sound, more, smoothed out and more, pop, I guess. What I was saying before, like his Heartbreak Hotel. If you listen to his first song, That's All Right, Mama, in comparison to that Heartbreak Hotel, by the time he gets to RCA, his first single on RCA, there's a drastic difference. You know, you can tell really that they've, you know, upped the engineering and upped the sound. And I love Sun Records. That's, you know, I love that primitive, raw, emotional feeling that they get on those records, that echo. You can't beat those records. But you know, by the time he got to RCA, they were more interested in watching the clock. You know, at Sun Records, you never had to watch the clock. They didn't care when you got done recording. At RCA, it was like a three-hour session. You had to get out of there, and so they wanted, you know, as much product as they could get in that three-hour time slot. And it was more professional and more more people involved too, even regarding the production and the distribution and the whole shebang. Because at Sun, it was such a small independent label; they could only do so much. So I don't know how to answer your question.
It does in a way. I'm thinking of I think it's Johnny Powers in your book, and he says, "We weren't calling it rockabilly; we were just calling it rock and roll." So I'm kind of wondering as well. You know, at what point did people start self-identifying themselves as rockabilly?
But see, rockabilly really wasn't a term used in the 50s. So that's why you don't hear people from the 50s referring to themselves as rockabillies. Plus, it was a derogatory term back then. Country stars would be on, like, Hank Snow or... Hank Snow is a good example. We'll give him as an example. He would be on the bill with, say, Elvis Presley or... some of the other guys, and Elvis would get more fan reaction than, say, Hank Snow. They would be yelling out, "Elvis, Elvis," you know, while he's trying to do his show. So him and some of the other bigger names in country started calling them rockabillies. And rockabillies to them was a derogatory term, like rock and hillbillies, you know, and they didn't want to be referred to as hillbillies because it was, you know, like, oh, you guys are a bunch of stupid, dumb country folk, you know. And so they didn't want to be termed as rockabillies. They preferred to call themselves rock and roll. And like I said, back in the day, rockabilly wasn't really a term that was used. It was used in some song titles, and Billboard used it a couple of times. But basically, people didn't really know what rockabilly was, so they just called it rock and roll. It wasn't until like the late 70s, early 80s, when Europe, they had never given up on rockabilly. They loved it all the way through. They started calling up Sonny Burgess and Billy Lee Riley and Glenn Glenn and all these guys, finding these people and calling them up and saying, "Hey, you know, the scene is big over here. We want you to come over here and tour." So then they came over there, and then that's when the term rockabilly really got to be popular, and everybody then was known as a rockabilly.
Right. And I know you don't want to keep going back to this, but I don't think it can be, this point can be overstated. And if you can address it, is what role do Elvis Presley and Sun Records play in the emergence of rockabilly?
Oh, if there was no Elvis Presley and Sun Records, I don't think there would be rockabilly. And I'm not saying that there weren't people doing rockabilly before Elvis, because there was. Glenn Glenn was doing it. Lou Williams was doing it. But Elvis broke down the door to rockabilly. I mean, they put Memphis on the map, Sun Records, Sam Phillips, Elvis Presley. I mean, you can't have rockabilly without, you know, those three principal players. I just can't imagine it. I mean, if anybody ever asks me, what is rockabilly? I always tell them, go listen to Elvis's Baby Let's Play House. That to me is the true definition of what rockabilly is. The bass, the thumping bass, stand-up bass, Scotty electric guitar, and Elvis's hiccupy vocals. That's just the epitome of rockabilly to me. And Sun Records with their echo tape delay echo that they had on their records. So there's no way in my mind that there could be rockabilly without Elvis going in the Sun studio on July 5th, 1954, and you know, recording "That's All Right, Mama." That really set the whole thing off, jump-started rockabilly, so to speak.
Rockabilly and rock and roll, as we've already been discussing, right?
Yes.
Okay, I thought at this point maybe we can get specific, a little bit more specific into your book. And as I said, it's a compilation of, I counted 46 different artists, and maybe I can get you to talk about some of them specifically. And there's no real order here other than ones I found interesting. So maybe if you could tell us a little bit about, it's from your section, chapter 5 on California rockabillies. Artists I really knew nothing about, the Collins Kids. Can you give us a little bit of story about them, please?
Well, the Collins Kids were a brother-sister act, and they started off when they were pretty young. I think Lori was like 14 and Larry was 12, something like that. And they came out to California. They're originally from Oklahoma, and they appeared weekly on Town Hall Party. And so they befriended guitar greats like Joe Mafis and Merle Travis and the whole cast, and they became a regular feature. So they got to feature their songs on their rockabilly songs. And Columbia Records was their record label. And unfortunately, Columbia had Mitch Miller as their A&R man. And Mitch Miller was very much into sing-alongs and folk and polkas and what have you. And he didn't have a clue what to do with a cutesy young rockabilly act like the Collins Kids. So they were pretty much sidelined to do novelty songs and stuff they really didn't want to do in the beginning, at least. And then they kind of rebelled and said, hey, we want to do our own stuff, you know. So then they started writing their own material and doing really hot numbers like Hoy Hoy and Hop, Skip, and Jump and Mercy and Whistle Bait and, you know, all these really great rockin' songs. And it's unfortunate that they didn't get I don't know if they really got any airplay. I know that they were on like Steve Allen and Ed Sullivan and places like that, but they didn't have any charted singles, unfortunately. And that's probably because of the promotion from Columbia. And what ended up happening is they disbanded in the early 60s because Larry Collins in love with Ricky Nelson and vice versa. And they were supposed to be married. They were engaged. But she ran off with Johnny Cash's manager, Stu Carnell, without telling Ricky. And that broke up her relationship with Ricky and also the act. So she went off and did her own thing for a while. And then they got back together finally. And Larry actually wrote a couple famous songs, Delta Dawn. And what's the other one? I know this, something about Oklahoma. Well, it doesn't matter. I'll think of it in a minute. But so then they got resurgence when the rockabilly revival came around in the early 90s. And they've been playing ever since. I've seen them like 5 times, and they're still great today. He still plays his double neck guitar, and it's just a really cool act to be able to see.
And he plays it well.
Yes, yes. You know, I get a kick out of when I see those old town hall party videos and see him on there, how he can spin around and jump around and do all that stuff and never miss a trick. It's really something to see. And he gets a kick out of that, too. He wonders where he got all the energy from.
You also include Ricky Nelson in your California rockabillies. What role does Hollywood play in, especially the California rockabilly scene, but also generally?
Okay, just a second. I thought of that song that I was going to say that Larry Collins had written. It's "You're the Reason God Made Oklahoma." He actually co-wrote it with Sandy Pinker. I had to look it up. Sorry about that. So he got to be pretty well known as a songwriter. But anyway, so what was your question about Ricky? I apologize.
Well, the question is generally about the California rockabilly scene. What role does Hollywood and movies and TV have in the California rockabilly scene?
I don't know in regard to like movies, but definitely TV because of Ricky Nelson. I mean, Ricky Nelson and The Adventures of Ozzy and Harriet helped to put rock and roll, rockabilly, what have you, on the map in Hollywood because he was on there weekly. And they had so many viewers. I mean, people would tune in just to see him sing. And, you know, they would have the episode, and then at the end, they would have one or two of his latest hits or upcoming releases that he would have on record. So I'm Walkin' actually was the first song that he ever sang on The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, April 4th, 1957. And that drew in so many viewers. I do believe he sold like a million copies in a short amount of time. And so then, like I said, after that, they just tuned in weekly. What song is Ricky going to sing this week? And then they'd run out and buy the song. So that definitely helped him get his songs on the charts and get them, you know, audiences when he'd go play live. And, you know, thousands and thousands of fan letters. I do believe he got like 10,000 a week. So, you know, TV definitely helped him in that respect and helped rockabilly rock and roll. Because then teenagers were like, oh, wow, what's this, you know, this new music? We got to go, you know, check this out. And so definitely that helped. And when Elvis was on Stage Show, which was a Tommy and Dorsey brothers, Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey brothers show, his appearances on there helped rock and roll. And there were some movies that were put out, but I don't really know if they're considered rockabilly more so than they are rock and roll, because like Chuck Berry was in on them and whatnot, like Rock, Rock, Rock and Mr. Rock and Roll and Jamboree and what have you. And those are wonderful movies, and those definitely helped, you know, rock and roll, because people would go to the movie theaters and see those movies. The Girl Can't Help It was really popular. They had a lot of stars in that one, Fats Domino and Eddie Cochran and Gene Vincent. There were some more rockabilly movies, but I don't think those really became popular until the resurgence, like in the 80s and 90s, like Rock Baby Rocket with Johnny Carroll and Carnival Rock with Bob Lumen and more of those cult classics. And they're great movies for the music, but they're lousy for the plot. So I usually fast forward through and just when I watch the musical segments. But I'm very glad they made those movies, because where else can you see Bob Lumen, you know? And he gave some really wild performances in that movie, Carnival Rock.
How about telling us a little bit about the importance of the Louisiana Hayride for rockabilly, as opposed to, say, the Grand Ole Opry?
Well, the Grand Ole Opry and the Louisiana Hayride were rivals. And usually what ended up happening was people would start on the Hayride or vice versa, and the other one would steal them, like that happened with Hank Williams. Anyway, the Louisiana Hayride was definitely more akin to accepting rockabilly performers, whereas the Grand Ole Opry was strictly country. You know, they wanted George Jones and Jim Reeves and, you know, people like that, and Hank Williams. I'm not saying the Louisiana Hayride didn't have country acts. It certainly did. It had Farron Young, and it had Hank Williams, and it had Jim Reeves. But it was more known for bringing in rockabillies and accepting rockabillies. Carl Perkins appeared on there, Wanda Jackson, Elvis was a regular, Bob Lumen was a regular, James Burton got his start on Louisiana Hayride. So definitely had a big impact on rockabilly and bringing in the teenagers, you know, once the young people left the hayride, the teenagers didn't attend it anymore. And it's kind of funny. Before they came in, it was basically an older crowd. But then Elvis showed up, and then the older crowd left, and all the teenagers showed up. So they brought in the younger crowd and the record-buying public at the time, you know, the teenagers who would go out to the jukeboxes and the record stores and buy their records and go to the shows and whatnot. So the Louisiana Hayride was very cool in that respect, that they accepted rockabilly and played rockabilly and recorded rockabilly. I mean, they didn't record actually there, but KWKH is the one that aired Louisiana Hayride, and KWKH wasn't too far from the Hayride. It was actually there in town in Shreveport, and it recorded some of the greatest rockabilly songs ever recorded, Susie Q by Dale Hawkins, and a couple of recordings by Bob Luman, and you know, different things by different people. And they had a local radio show that they aired every morning. Max Brothers and Rose came on there Sunday mornings right after the Hayride Saturday night. So they did a lot. You know, the city of Shreveport helped definitely to contribute to the whole rockabilly movement with the Louisiana Hayride and KWKH.
One of the artists you have in your Louisiana Hayride section is Wanda Jackson. Can you tell us a bit about her, please?
Well, Wanda Jackson back in the day was really chastised and criticized for being as wild as she was, or what they thought wild was. I mean, the 1950s overall was pretty conservative, the Eisenhower era. And, you know, you weren't supposed to wear fringe dresses and shake like she did, and wear high heels and makeup and jewelry and look as flashy as she did, and sing those songs like Mean Mean Man and Fuji Yama Mama, and, you know, all these risque songs, and the respect that, you know, they didn't see women doing that. They saw men doing that. And, you know, for a woman to get up there and do that, she really broke a lot of boundaries. And she actually had gone on the Grand Ole Opry, her only appearance. I think maybe she's been on there since, but back in the day, it was her only appearance. And she was backstage waiting, and she had her pretty fringed dress on that her mother had just made. And it was kind of low-necked. It was a sweetheart neckline, and she was really feeling confident. And Ernest Tubb comes back, and he says, Wanda Jackson? And she says, yes, that's me. He says, well, you're on next. She says, oh, wonderful, I'm ready. He says, well, you can't go out there like that. And she says, well, what do you mean? She, you know, I'm ready to go. And he says, no, you can't. You got to put something over that. You can't go out there with bare shoulders. She had, you know, a sleeveless dress on. And so she had a fringed, beat-up kind of jacket, and she threw it on, and she went out there, and she sang her song. She got off the stage, and she was crying. And she said to her dad, she says, I'm never coming here back here again. Let's get out of here. You know, she was so embarrassed that, you know, they wouldn't allow her to appear on the Opry like that. She helped pioneer, you know, the rockabilly women's movement, so to speak, because she was one of the first ones to do what she was doing and have that growl in her voice and that raw edge, you know, that most of the guys were doing. And for her to get out there and say, hey, women can do it too, you know, that was pretty cool. And she just got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I do believe last year or the year before, which was really cool. And certainly deserved. She deserved to be in there a long time ago. So very, very good
right.
for her.
So we can segue a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit more, if there is more to say, about the role of women in rockabilly throughout history?
Well, there weren't that many women to begin with. Like I said, there was Wanda Jackson, and there was Lori Collins from the Collins Kids, and Jazz Martin. Jazz Martin got a lot of criticism, too, because she used to sing on stage barefoot. And she was actually dubbed the female Elvis. In fact, I think a lot of people are called that, but I think she was the first one to get called that. And there were others, too. Jerry Lee Lewis's sister, Linda Gale, she did some rockabilly, and Barbara Pittman. And there were a handful. Laura Lee Perkins, she's in my book. There were a handful, but basically, like I said, in the 50s, women were considered to be more submissive and should stay at home and raise the children and be a housewife more so than getting out on stage and shaking and rocking and singing those wild songs and traveling on the road and whatnot. So, and it's a hard life too, you know, going from city to city and not making much pay and having to, you know, clean up and dress up maybe in a bathroom stall and don't know where you're going to sleep that night or if you're going to get paid. And, you know, it's rough. So for those women to be troubadours like they were, you know, it took a lot of guts and you know, really showcased, you know, that they had enough wherewithal to be out on the scene like that. And like I said, it influenced a lot of people after that. I have Kim Lanz and Marti Brahm in the book, and they were influenced by Wanda and Janice. And there's many, many more females now on the scene, probably more today than ever. A friend of mine was going to write a book actually on the women of rockabilly. And I had given him a list of all the rockabilly females that I could think of, and I couldn't believe how many there were. There's probably like at least 100 that I know of. So it's really cool to see, you know, women getting out there and singing and performing and showcasing their talents too, because there are a lot of talented female rockabillies out there.
Sure. Now, maybe we can go back to the Sun Legend section now. In doing a little bit of research, mainly, you know, looking up artists online and listening to their music, one that I found interesting was Carl Mann. Can you speak about him a little bit, please?
Well, Carl Mann is from Jackson, Tennessee, and he started out, I do believe he was like 17 years old, and he recorded there at Sun. He was one of the last artists, or I actually think the last artist to record at Sun before they transferred over to Philips International. That label, it was still in Memphis, but it was a different label. And he did Mona Lisa, and Mona Lisa was a big hit for Nat King Cole back in the 40s. And Carl rocked it up. He put a more rockabilly feel to it and got to be pretty big. I do believe it was number 20 on the charts. And he got a lot of fame from that, touring around the country and performing for different audiences. Like he actually did the summer dance party, which was a knockoff on the winter dance party that killed Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper. So he got to play the same venue there in Clear Lake, and he saw their signatures on the wall and whatnot. He took the same tour, you know, like the same cities that they hit. And actually, a little side note in regard to Mona Lisa, Carl actually recorded it, but it wasn't released. Sam Phillips sat on it. So while he was sitting on it, Conway Twitty got word that he had recorded it and it hadn't been released. So Conway released it. And I think it actually became a bigger hit for Conway than Carl. And then Sam was like, uh-oh, I think we better get this out. So then he finally released it. But I don't know if it would have been released otherwise if it hadn't been for Conway Twitty recording it and releasing it and having, you know, a bigger hit with it. But Carl's a great guy, and he just started up touring again recently. For a long time, like 20, 30 years, he wasn't doing anything, and he got back into it recently. And I'll actually be seeing him in September. He's playing the Rockin' E Jamboree in Green Bay. I've seen him before, and he sounds today as good as he did back in the 50s. So it's really cool to see him and, you know, these other people still playing.
A lot of these original artists, they kind of stopped around, you know, in the early 60s or so and did all sorts of odd side jobs, and they've only been coming back in the last 15 or 20 years, right?
Yes. Well, see, what happened is after 58, rockabilly died here. I mean, you'd have a hit here, I mean, a song here every now and then that might be rockabilly, but basically, you know, it was forgotten about. The Beatles came over in the British Invasion and Bob Dylan and what have you. So in 58, that was probably the last time that it was charted on the Billboard charts. And then teen idols came in, like Frankie Avalon and Fabian and, you know, those kind of singers. So it made for a change, a transition in the music scene. And it wasn't really until the Stray Cats came to America in like 1982. And they had a top 10 single with Rock This Town. They really put rockabilly back on the map and said, hey, you know, we're still here, you know, don't forget about us. And then, like I said, they started getting a lot of calls over here, the originals, saying, hey, come over to Europe and play our festivals. And Hemsby was like one of the first festivals, which was in England, still is. I think they're like on their 45th one or something. They have two times a year. a festival, and they were going over there, and now today they go to Spain and France and Italy, and you wouldn't believe all the festivals they have in Europe. In fact, fans complain there's too many to choose from. But Europe really kept it going, like I said, all along. And they were bringing 50s acts even over before that, like in the 60s and 70s. Not so much rockabilly people, but rock and roll like Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Bill Haley and, you know, guys like that. They just really embraced the music over there and have kept it going. And over here, and especially over there, they have record hops where they play all rockabilly or rock and roll, and they have these festivals, like I said, and people dress up in 50s style. You know, they have the 50s ducktail hairdos and the 50s clothing and all the merchandise that you could think of, you know, whether it's CDs or records or vintage clothing or whatever. And they sell all that over there at the festivals, and it's really something to see all that. It's really cool.
It seems also that Canada has embraced rockabilly. Is that right?
I'm not too familiar with what's going on in Canada. I mean, I know some of the rockabillys have toured there, like Art Adams is pretty successful there, and I've heard some of the other people, but I don't know. I'm not too familiar. I know Ronnie Hawkins lives there. He's retired now, but he had a pretty good thing going on there for a while, and some of the other guys did get popularity in Canada after it kind of died down here in the States, like Ray Smith and Conway Twitty, and of course Ronnie Hawkins. So yeah, in the early 60s, I would definitely say they embraced it, and they might even be so today, but I don't hear that much about what's going on in Canada. It's mostly over in Europe and Australia. Even Japan, rockabilly is pretty popular over there. They have festivals over there.
I suppose my Canada question was meant to be a transition into a discussion of Ronnie Hawkins. Can you talk about Ronnie Hawkins a bit?
Well, from what I hear, Ronnie was quite a performer back in the day, and I didn't get as much information as I would have liked to. I thought I had more, but then I went back and listened to the tape, and I was like, uh-oh. And his health hasn't been too good in recent years. He had a bout with cancer, pancreatic cancer, in fact, and I guess he's okay now, but like I said, he's no longer performing, and he was quite a wildcat back in the day, and he actually had Bob Dylan's band, the band, as his original lineup of the Hawks, and they went on to go with Bob Dylan, of course, and have fame of their own. But like Robbie Robertson and Levon Helm were original members with Ronnie Hawkins down in Arkansas, and they used to play all the nightclubs down there, like the Silver Moon and Porky's and the Hot Spots. In Newport, Arkansas, and that I do believe it's Highway 67, all the clubs along there. So he was pretty cool. I have stories about him, but I don't think I'll share them because they're kind of embarrassing. But he was quite an entertainer. I mean, he used to jump around and do splits and crawl on top of stuff and kind of like Ray Smith. You know, I talk about him in the book, and he was another, seemed to be a wild one, you know, hanging from the rafters and doing whatever, you know, just to get the audience entranced. So,
There are a couple places in your book, one or two places where there is this connection made between, someone says that rockabilly was the punk rock of its day or some such thing. Maybe really we were talking earlier about the distinction between rock and roll and rockabilly, if there is one. Was rockabilly maybe a little bit more the wild side of rock and roll, maybe?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like I was saying earlier, it's raw and it's primitive, and there's a lot of hollering, and there's a lot of, emotion put into the lyrics. And not to say that rock and roll isn't, because, you know, Little Richard certainly was that way, but I mean, I can give a good example. Like I compare the rock and roll trio, Johnny Burnett, Dorsey Burnett, and Paul Burleson, to punk music. I would say they're the grandfathers of punk. If you listen to them, they're way out there. I mean, in the comparison to, like, say, other people of the day of the 50s, like, you know, Pat Boone or Perry Como, I mean, you're like, whoa, where'd they come from? You know, so, you know, I could see where people like that back in the 50s wouldn't get airplay. I mean, they wouldn't know what to do. you know, like, whoa, you know, sounds like it's from Mars, you know. Or even, he's not in the book, but Billy Lee Riley, he's another one that was pretty wild. And out there, you know, when they were listening to those records, you know, I know they were popular down south, but when you would get up into the northern regions, if the records were even played up there, you know, they must have thought, wow, where is this coming from, you know? So I could definitely see where rockabilly had its influence on punk music.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the more recent rockabillies then? In the rockabilly revivalist section, say someone like High Noon. What about them? Tell us a little bit, please.
Well, High Noon has had a lot of success on their own, but they also play with Ronnie Dawson, and they got a chance to play a couple times in the Conan O'Brien show, which is really cool. And Carnegie Hall, they played. So they've gotten, you know, some success in that respect. They were one of the bands that started off in the Washington, D.C. area, and there was a real resurgence of rockabilly in that particular area with Go Cat Go and High Noon and Tex Rabinowitz and Billy Hancock and Danny Gatton. You know, it was a circulated. Some spots in America have, you know, a lot of rockabillies like L.A. and Austin, Texas, and Washington, D.C. You know, there's certain spots. They just happen, for whatever reason, to have a lot of rockabillies, or even Memphis back in the 50s. So, you know, they were playing the circuit with all those people, Go Cat Go and, you know, whatnot. And they still get together every once in a while and play. And, of course, they have their own solo careers now. And but they did pretty well for themselves as a band when they first started. And like I said, they were one of the first ones to really get things going again over here and getting, you know, shows put together where it was all rockabilly and festivals here in the States and whatnot.
And another interesting one from the revivalist section is Tex Rabinowitz. He seems like he was might have been a little bit older than a lot of the other revivalists. Is that right?
Yeah, and he is, and it was really difficult for me to get an interview out of him because he's real reclusive nowadays. He's upset with what happened with him in regard to the music industry. And he's, you know, and this is a point well taken. He thought that he should have been a bigger star than he was, and he wasn't, and it kind of has bittered him. So he's real reclusive, and for me to get an interview, I was really proud of myself for that, and he really gave me an extensive interview, and he's a pretty nice guy, and he did some cool songs, you know, back in the 80s and whatnot. So I don't know what else I could say about him except, you know, he was part of that.
Well, you say he was upset about what happened to him in the industry. Can you go into more detail about that?
Just that he didn't have any hits and that, you know, he wasn't really too much embraced outside the Washington, D.C. area and, you know, that sort of thing. So he thought he would be, you know, more popular than he was.
Right.
Not to interrupt, but can I talk about two different artists? Because I told my friends that I would. So
please, too. This is a great time for you. Here's a question,
okay.
Sheree. Why don't you pick a few artists out of your book that I haven't mentioned to talk about, please?
Okay. Well, one of them is Glenn, and he had a song called Lori Ann, which was more kind of a poppy song, but, you know, he did rockabilly certainly too. And Lori Ann was actually number one in L.A. and in Hawaii, and it was featured on American Bandstand. And they wanted him to come on American Bandstand and perform it, but he was stationed in the Army at the time, and the Army wouldn't allow him to get discharged temporarily to go there. So he couldn't promote his record, and therefore it didn't get any chart success nationwide, which is really a shame. But he had some really cool records back in the day, and he got to play with Max Brothers and Rose, and he has some of their nudie suits still in his collection, the famous nudie suits with the rhinestones and the sequins and embroidery. And he did Everybody's Moving, and he had Eddie Cochran's bass player as his own bass player, and he did a lot of the shows, you know, out in California. There were other things besides Town Hall Party, and he did, you know, some of those other local shows there. And his cousin is Porter Wagner, so he got to tour with him and got to get to know a lot of the country stars and whatnot. And then there was another artist that I wanted to speak about. Larry Cole, he's actually the last artist in the book. And he lives out in Las Vegas, and he does rockabilly, and he actually tries to combine a little bit of country rock into his music, too. He does a lot of his own stuff, but he plays the Jackson Rockabilly Festival every year, and he'll do songs like that are Elvis's or Carl Perkins or, you know, Conway Twitty. And he was inducted into the Rockabilly Hall of Fame in 2006. He was actually the youngest member. And when he started his career in 92, he got to open for Carl Perkins, which was a big highlight for him, and got to become friends with him. And Carl was kind of a mentor. And Ronnie McDonald, he opened for him on a couple shows and got to do fanfare in Nashville with him a couple times. So he's just a really great artist, and hope that he gets more popularity that he has in recent years. He's just basically played here in the States, out like in Las Vegas or in Jackson, Tennessee, and Memphis area. But I hope that, you know, other festivals latch on and check out his act.
And he simply goes by Cole, is that right?
Yeah, now it is. Yeah, but his real name is Larry Cole, so that's why I said that. But yeah, he goes by Cole nowadays.
Right. Are there any other artists that I've missed in the book that you want to tell us about?
I mean, I could stay here all day and talk about every one of them, but I'll stop at that because I know your hour's about up. So.
Well, what outlets are there for rockabilly bands these days, whether recorded or live?
What do you mean in respect to people coming out and seeing them, or
both? Are there record labels that focus on rockabilly these days? Do they? I know there's these. That's for recorded, but also live.
Mm-hmm.
There's these festivals you've mentioned, right?
Right, right. Well, there's the Viva Las Vegas Weekender. They do that every year out in Vegas. They've done it 14 years. It'll be the 15th, I do believe, next year. And that's really successful. They have a lot of bands on there, and thousands of people come out. They just had Jerry Lee Lewis, and I do believe the crowd attendance was like 15,000 or something ridiculous. So they're really successful with that. And they've had festivals up in Green Bay called the Rockin' 50s Fest. They had three of those in 2002, 2005, and 2007. And last year and this year, they've had a Rockin' E Jamboree, which is kind of cool. They have, you know, Elvis tribute artists. And this year they're having more rockabillies like Carl Mann and Sonny Burgess, and the Crickets are all playing it. And they have a thing that goes on in Seattle, Washington, Shake the Shack Ball, it's called. And they used to have one in Indianapolis. I don't know if they're still doing it. I think they are, but I think it's kind of scaled down simply because of the economy. But that was the Rockabilly Rebel Weekender. And, of course, they have things going on all the time in L.A., you know, and there's clubs that you can play. And Chicago has a pretty good scene. And, of course, down in Texas and in Austin, they do a lot of stuff down there. And sometimes things happen in Arkansas, like the Newport, Jonesboro area. Memphis and Nashville sometimes have things going on. So there's several places to play. And, of course, over in Europe, there's, you know, so many festivals to play in clubs. And New York, there's places there to play. And so I think rockabilly is definitely making a comeback. I mean, I'll get fashion magazines and there'll be sometimes references to rockabilly clothing, like the style is rockabilly. Or there was even an article about Wanda Jackson's recent album in there, giving it high praise in Elle magazine.
Mm.
So you see a little article here and there. And the Million Dollar Quartet, which is a musical based on the Sun Session that included Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Elvis Presley, that one occasion in December 1956. They're going around. They have a production in Chicago. They have one in New York. It was on Broadway for a year. It's actually going off Broadway next month. But then they're going to start a tour, a nationwide tour here in the States. And also it's going on in London. So that's really cool for rockabilly. And just little things here and there that, you know, come up. And so there is quite a bit going on. I wouldn't say it's lucrative in regard to money. I mean, there's really not that much going on for the legends get paid really well, but unfortunately the newer artists don't. The majority don't get paid that great. So it's because they don't have the status, and you know, promoters are cheap and whatnot. So, you know, and I can understand where the promoters are coming from, but I also feel sympathy for the artists. I think everyone should get paid decent, you know. So, there are a lot of places to play, but as in regard to recording, a lot of the artists have their own record label and their own studio. So they do their own thing, like Kim Lenz and Geek Dickerson, and Larry Cole has his own record label. So basically, you know, they do their own thing and put it out and, you know, hope for the best. But because record labels don't want to really take a chance on rockabilly, very few out there. I can't even think of any big ones off the top of my head that have any rockabilly artists. They're just, they don't know how to market it. It's the same with me in regard to finding a publisher. They just don't know what rockabilly is, and they don't know how to market it. So it's really unfortunate that there's no big time label out there that would take a chance on rockabilly like they did in the 80s with the Stray Cats. Because I would love to see rockabilly on MTV and VH1 and in the charts, you know. But I don't know if that'll ever happen again.
Well, what are you up to these days, Cherie? You mentioned you're writing a book about Buddy Holly. Is that right?
No, Ricky Nelson.
Oh, Ricky Nelson. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Yeah, I'm currently working on that as to the publisher in September. So next year sometime it'll be coming out. And I'm really excited about that project because I wanted to write a book about Ricky a long time ago. He's my second favorite artist. Elvis is my favorite. But I got to interview a lot of really great people, ones that worked on the show and a lot of his musicians and producers and whatnot. So I think it's really going to be a cool book. It's going to be called Rick Nelson, Musical Memories of a Hollywood Heartthrob. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to that. And like I said, I'm going to be doing a follow-up to the rockabilly book. And of course, I try to go to as many shows and festivals as possible. Like I said, I'm going to a festival in September. The Rockin' E Jamboree, where they have some rockabilly artists. And I just try to get out there and support the rockabilly movement, music, scene, whatever, as much as possible, whether it's buying CDs or going to the shows or whatever I can do. You know, I want to help the scene.
You write articles as well?
Yeah, I've written for Blue Suede News and some of the other publications, Keep Rockin', which isn't in... It doesn't exist anymore, but I did a couple for them, and so I you know, I try to get out there in regard to that too, writing articles and keeping people informed of what I'm up to and what the artists are up to.
Right. Well, it's a great book, Cherie. We talked off mic. It's in a number of collegiate libraries. It's a great reference book, I think, for anybody who. I mean, I learned a lot about many artists that I hadn't heard of. I want to, you know, thank you for writing the book, and thank you for giving me an interview.
Thank you, and I don't know, did we mention the title? I don't even know if we did.
Oh, we can again. It's Catch That Rockabilly Fever, Personal Stories of Life on the Road and in the Studio.
Okay, and should I tell people where they can get it or no?
Please do.
Okay. Amazon has it, Barnes & Noble, you can order it from. For people listening overseas, you can go to your local bookstore and ask them to order it for you. And I know if you do a Google search, a lot of websites come up where you can order it. eBay has it sometimes, and Tower Records Online, and Overstock.com, and there's a bunch of them, so people won't have any trouble finding it. Just type in Catch That Rockabilly Fever by Cherie Holmer, and you should be able to find it without any problem. And I hope that people enjoy the interview, and hopefully I answered some questions relatively well about rockabilly and the artists, and that they'll be intrigued enough to go pick up a copy.
Okay, well, thank you for being on our show, Cherie.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Cherie Holmer, author of Catch That Rockabilly Fever, Personal Stories of Life on the Road and in the Studio, a 2010 release on McFarlane & Company. Please check the New Books and Popular Music site regularly for more interviews with authors of books about popular music. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. Thanks for listening.